Marge Hansel will now share our scripture from Connecticut.
The reading comes from the book of Exodus, and it is indeed the story of the Exodus of the people of Israel from Egypt. The angel of God, who was going before the Israelite army, moved and went behind them. And the pillar of cloud moved from in front of them and took its place behind them. It came between the army of Egypt and the army of Israel. And so the cloud was there with the darkness, and it lit up the night. One did not come near the other all night. Then Moses stretched out his hand over the sea. The Lord drove the sea back by a strong east wind all night and turned the sea into dry land, and the waters were divided. The Israelites went into the sea on dry ground, the waters forming a wall for them on their right and on their left. The Egyptians pursued and went into the sea after them, all of Pharaoh's horses, chariots, and chariot drivers. At the morning watch, the Lord in the pillar of fire and the cloud looked down upon the Egyptian army and threw the Egyptian army into panic. He clogged their chariot wheels so that they turned with difficulty. The Egyptians said, "Let us flee from the Israelites, for the Lord is fighting for them against Egypt." Then the Lord said to Moses, "Stretch out your hand over the sea so that the water may come back upon the Egyptians, upon their chariots and chariot drivers." So Moses stretched out his hand over the sea, and at dawn the sea returned to its normal depth. As the Egyptians fled before it, the Lord tossed the Egyptians into the sea. The waters returned and covered the chariots and chariot drivers. The entire army of Pharaoh that had followed them into the sea, not one of them remained. But the Israelites walked on dry ground through the sea, the waters forming a wall for them on their right and on their left. Thus the Lord saved Israel that day from the Egyptians. And Israel saw the Egyptians dead on the seashore. Israel saw the great work that the Lord did against the Egyptians. So the people feared the Lord and believed in the Lord and in his servant Moses.
Thank you, Marge. This reading we just heard is one of the climax moments of what we call the Exodus story, as Marge said. This story tells of the liberation of the Hebrew people who had been slaves in Egypt. It's a defining story of the Old Testament and of Jewish identity and understanding of God. God brought them out of Egypt. God set them free from slavery. And after 40 years in the wilderness, God brought them into the promised land. Every year at the Passover Seder, people retell and reenact this story of God's liberating actions. God is understood as one who sees and hears human suffering. God is the God on the side of the oppressed. God is not totally removed from human history, but God is understood to act within history in ways sometimes great and obvious and sometimes small and unseen. God is liberator, deliverer, and redeemer. God cares about human suffering, and God works for justice and freedom. This Exodus story has become a foundational story not just for Jewish people, but for all sorts of people undergoing suffering and oppression. Latin American theologians over the last 60 years have claimed this story to redefine traditional Catholic theology into liberation theology. African American believers brought to America as slaves and living in the last 400 years under racism have claimed this story and their understanding of God as their hope and their faith. In this difficult and challenging time we are living in, I wonder what this Exodus story offers us. What challenge and hope does it bring to our faith? What do we really believe about God and God's movements within the events of our times? Is God at work, working for justice, seeking to free captives and let the oppressed go free? Or is it all up to us? In our 21st century world, we've so divided the material world and the spiritual world. What do we believe is possible for God to do in our time? We see the environmental crisis, the fires, the floods, the droughts, the storms. We are living in the midst of this pandemic, and we are in the middle of a political and social and economic crisis. Our democratic institutions are threatened by populism and white nationalism. There are protesters crying for justice and systemic change. In this time, it's hard to know and hard to see, where is God? I realize this week in a new way that the Exodus story is about a political, social, and economic crisis. Moses showing up in Pharaoh's court, demanding that the slaves be freed, created a huge crisis. For the Hebrew people, it was a crisis of faith. Should they trust Moses? Could they trust that God was finally doing something to help them? Or was Moses' actions only going to make things worse? For the Egyptians, it was a political crisis. What should they do about this social unrest, these agitators demanding freedom? To set the slaves free would create an economic and social crisis. How would their society function? Who would do the work? And when, finally, after weeks and months, we're not sure how long, but a long period of Moses' demands and God's and Pharaoh saying no, and then God sending the plagues, when the Hebrews are finally set free, all of that erupts. 3 weeks ago, when Edie Regan preached, she began this Exodus story talking about the five brave women whose resistance to injustice saved the life of the baby Moses. Their actions, their choices, and their courage set in motion this drama of liberation. As a man, Moses fled Egypt after killing a slave master who had been beating a Hebrew slave. He wandered in the wilderness, found a family, learned to live out there watching after sheep and goats. But then one day Moses encountered God in a burning bush, and God told him to go back to Egypt, to stand in front of Pharaoh and demand that Pharaoh let the Hebrews go free. Moses was afraid, uncertain, didn't think there was any way he could speak like that in public. The Hebrews won't trust me, and Pharaoh will want to kill me, he said. When God insists, Moses questions God. Who are you? Who should I tell them has sent me? Tell them that I am has sent you, God answered. I am the source of all life, the great mystery, the one who knows and sees all things. Called into faith, made bold by this encounter, this experience of God, Moses went back. Armed with his shepherd's rod and the help of his brother Aaron, Moses managed to persuade the Hebrew slaves to support him. And then he stood before Pharaoh, demanding freedom. And Pharaoh laughed. Who was Moses to tell him what to do? So Pharaoh just increased the slaves' suffering. He bore down on oppression, telling them they had to find their own straw for their bricks, trying to turn them against Moses, trying to frighten them back into submission. But then God began to act. God sent 10 plagues, each as a warning sign to pressure Pharaoh and his counselors. The plagues grew in intensity and the damage they brought. Time and again, Pharaoh seemed to repent. Okay, you can go. But as soon as the plague was ended, he went back, reversing himself, reinstating all the injustice. Until finally the 10th plague struck down every firstborn son in every Egyptian household, from the poorest to the house of Pharaoh himself. The system of injustice and violence had refused to change until finally the suffering and the violence came home to the Egyptians, not just to the slaves. It's a frightening, in many ways brutal story, and we cringe, I think, to think of this as the hand of God. Just as in this passage we read today, we may cringe a little bit when we know that the Hebrew people were told danced and sang on the far side of that sea as they saw the army of Pharaoh swallowed up by the waters. In what's believed to be the most ancient text in the whole of the Old Testament, we have the song of Miriam and the women dancing and shaking their tambourines. Sing to the Lord, for God has triumphed gloriously. Horse and rider God has thrown into the sea. Before we cringe, before we judge them too harshly, let us remember the violence they have suffered. Let us remember all they had endured, the generations of slavery, baby boys slaughtered, back-breaking labor, whippings, cursing, sexual assault. Pharaoh had finally given in and said they could go, but then once again Pharaoh had changed his mind, saying, "What have we done letting Israel leave our service?" Because Egyptian society was put into crisis when he set the slaves free. Who was going to do the manual labor? Who was going to be their servants? I've never really thought about the effect of this liberation on the Egyptians. Their privilege and their power was suddenly broken down as the slaves were set free. And just as we know has happened so many times since and continues to happen today, those who have power and privilege don't want to let it go because it hurts. It's uncomfortable. It can even bring suffering. You have to give things up. So Pharaoh and his advisors had changed their mind and sent their horses and chariots and their army after them. And the Hebrews, when they saw them, were terrified. And they cried out to Moses, "Was it because there were no graves in Egypt that you've taken us all this way out to just let us die in the wilderness? Isn't this what we told you could happen? It would have been better to just stay in Egypt and keep on serving as slaves than to die out here in the wilderness." But Moses told them, "Don't be afraid. Watch and see God's deliverance." And as the night fell and the sign of God's presence, the cloud, the pillar of fire came between them and the Egyptians, and Moses, at God's command, held out his hand over the waters, and the waters parted. And the Hebrew people, we are told, passed through on dry ground. Now, the image we may have in our minds is from Charlton Heston and the Ten Commandments. Huge, high walls of water on either side. Who knows? Who knows what it really looked like or exactly what happened? It's not even quite clear where they were. Red Sea, Sea of Reeds, a marshy area. It's not all quite clear. What we know, what the story's claim is this. They escaped the power of Egypt. They were delivered from their suffering and their oppression, and their masters were no more. They were set free from slavery, and in their delight, in their deliverance, they danced and sang. Free at last, thank God Almighty, we're free at last. Maybe only those who have lived with lifelong injustice and oppression can truly imagine their joy. But no matter our privilege, we all know those longings we have for the world to be more of what it should be. And I have to confess that in the last 4 years, I have learned a lot more about my own capacity for outrage and anger and my desire for revenge. We see so much that is wrong in our world, in our country. We see suffering and injustice and oppression of so many people and of the earth itself. We see so much inequality, so much greed, so much power and privilege for a few. And we want it to end. We want the systems of violence and injustice to be broken. We want justice to roll down like waters and righteousness like an ever-flowing stream. And so, yes, if the perpetrators, if the oppressors choose to go charging into those waters of God's justice with their weapons, with their laws twisted to benefit only themselves, if they keep on pursuing their victims, keep on oppressing those who suffer, then let the waters of God's justice sweep them away. You know, as we think about this account, it's interesting to think about who we identify with, because we're conditioned to think of ourselves as people of faith, and so to identify with the Hebrews. But there is another, maybe painful possibility. As Americans, as mostly white people, as people with some economic privilege, in some ways, our natural allies are not the Hebrew slaves. In many ways, we are Egyptians, not Pharaoh, not his officials, not the slave masters, but the ordinary, everyday Egyptians who were benefiting from the bodies and backs of the Hebrew slaves. The people whose labor benefits us are often invisible to us, maybe not in this country, somewhere else in the world working for a few dollars a day, or their laborers who are in our communities but are hidden from our lives much of the time. Essential workers who've had to work throughout the pandemic, but they don't live in our neighborhoods and we don't ride on the bus with them. We don't know them and we don't see them so much of the time. This story challenges us to ask ourselves, what does it mean to take the side of the oppressed? What does it mean to join with them? How do we need to change our lives to be on the side of God's justice? And at another level, this story also asks us to consider, how are we held captive? How are we enslaved? What deliverance do we desperately need but can't even see? What kind of liberation do we long for? What freedom is God offering us? But it requires us to let go of what we know and what we understand. To get to freedom, the slaves had to leave behind everything they knew. We hear their fear, their challenge to Moses. Did you bring us out here in the wilderness just to let us die? It would have been better to stay as slaves in Egypt. Their fear of the unknown, their difficulty in trusting God makes them want to go back to Egypt. But the only way to freedom, the only way to God's deliverance, is to leave behind all they know. They had to let go and give it all up. They could take nothing with them. They had to walk by faith through those waters and into a wilderness, hoping it would take them to the promised land. I just finished reading Barbara Kingsolver's 2019 novel, Unsheltered. It weaves together two stories from two different times of social unrest and uncertainty and upheaval in beliefs, the 1870s and 2016. Not surprisingly, it's the contemporary story that spoke most to me, 2016 America. In the shadow of the rise of Trump, whom King Solver only names as the bullhorn, it's the story of a falling apart of one family's American dream. The mother, Willa, is a journalist who's lost her steady job just before her husband lost his tenured faculty position at a small college that went bankrupt. In the process, they lose their home. But they've inherited a house in New Jersey from an aunt, and so they go to live there, only to find that the house is falling apart. Their high-achieving son loses his girlfriend, is left with a small baby, no job, and a mountain of student debt. And their rebellious, punky daughter, after somehow spending 2 years in Cuba, shows up on the doorstep. On top of all this, the father-in-law, who is a first-generation immigrant and right-wing radio Trump fan, is suffering from the last stages of unmanaged diabetes, and it's their turn to take care of him. You know, it may sound like a bit too much, but somehow it's also all very possible in this America we're living in. As things go from bad to worse, Willa's forced to give up more and more, not just space in the house as the roof leaks and the heat won't work, but many of her hopes and beliefs about them as a family. And unexpectedly for her, and I confess for me, the person who emerges as a source of wisdom is the daughter. She seems to have done nothing much with her life so far, and yet she's the one who rises to the occasion to nurture her brother's baby, to take care of her grandfather, putting up with his racist comments, to find ways to scrounge good meals, and to reach out and find community among their neighbors, even as her family seems to be falling apart. As Willa grieves, all that has turned out has not turned out the way she hoped, and tries to figure out what to do with this house falling down around them, the daughter says, "Poor mom, I know. It feels like the end of the world when you can't have the things you always wanted. But it's not the end of the world. There's some other place to go." Her mom shakes her head. "Sorry, I have to tell you, but that's an old saying. My mother used to say all the time, when God slams a door, God opens a window." Her daughter shook her head and said, "No, that's not the same thing. I'm saying that when God slams a door on you, it's probably because you're in the midst of a terrible storm and you're going to end up in rubble. But it's okay. Without all that crap overhead, you might realize you're standing in daylight." Her mom says, "Without a roof over your head, it kind of feels like you might die." "Yeah," her daughter says, "but you might not. For one thing is for sure, you won't find your way out of the mess if you keep walking around picking up bricks and stuffing them in your pockets. What you have to do is to look up for blue sky." God's deliverance comes in all sorts of unexpected ways. For Willa, it's letting go of her illusions about herself and her family, and the American dream that what matters is the house and the jobs and the money in the bank, and American society as she has thought it works. As it all falls apart, but she finally stops trying to rescue the bricks and the rubble, she realizes she is standing in daylight and there is blue sky. She is freed up. Freed of her worries and fears of what might get lost and how she might fail because it's already happened. And yet she is alive. They are alive. And there are people to love who love them back. And there is freedom to want less, to use less, and to be more joyful. God is at work in our lives, in our human history, in all sorts of ways. Sometimes we see it and we realize it when it's happening. Much of the time, we only recognize it when we look back. And right now, in the midst of so much upheaval and crisis, so much that is dangerous and frightening, our faith promises that God is at work in us, among us. God knows our suffering. God hears our cries. God understands our fears. And God does not ever leave us alone. God is with us. Our faith challenges us, urges us to let go of any and every way we contribute to the pain and suffering of others. And our faith calls us out of Egypt to leave behind all the things that lock us up and hold us captive, to trust that by God's grace we will have what we need to make our way through the wilderness. And as we go, we can still sing and dance, knowing that in the face of all that threatens us, in spite of all that feels like it might destroy us, God is at work to deliver us into freedom and into joy.